Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia?
Started to burn too many things we found. This is Harvey Slugo Wasserman back here with another hour here in Solartopia. We've got a great deal of stuff to talk about. We're going to talk about Ted Vail out in here in California. Ted, you with us, buddy?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, man. How'd you do in the fires?
I'm in eastern Malibu. It was in western right. Malibu. It's been really rough for people out here in western Malibu. 600
yeah, did they,
homes burned.
Ted Vail, I've been to your beautiful house in Malibu, and I'm thankful that you're still standing, and it's still standing. Were you forced to evacuate?
Everyone in Malibu was forced to evacuate, and it was a terrible situation because there was a highway of death potential on the coast highway because they were backed up for miles. They should have just evacuated western Malibu first and then eastern Malibu, but everybody got on the road 4 or 5 hours. Fortunately, the fires did not come in until most people had evacuated. But if that hadn't happened, it would have been a paradise all over again. Or as Donald Trump calls it, a pleasure.
Pleasure, yeah, God. Well, thank God you're okay. We had Lance Simmons on the show from Malibu who had to evacuate also. And, right. You know, 13,000 people turned into a ghost town. Jeez. I mean, it's just hard to comprehend. And I want to say right now,
unfortunately, a number of people stayed, and then the cops refused to let anyone come in for days to help them. They were trying to bring in supplies. So they ultimately got boats, and they brought them in on boats and surfboards to reach the people who were trying to put the fires out that still existed. This is a coming scandal.
Well, you know, and for me, we're in a country here where we spend $1 trillion a year on the military. I don't know why they couldn't, you know, brought the Army in and brought the Navy in. I mean, we have these people standing around, brave, young, healthy people in the military who, with all the equipment in the world to destroy the world, why couldn't we use some of that stuff to save people? I mean, it's just really
infuriating to me. They're understaffed with firemen. What firemen were here were up north in Thousand Oaks, or some of them had gone north to Paradise, and there were no real large numbers of fire trucks or aircraft overhead to fight the fire. People who stayed tried to put out the fires, the spot fires, after the main fire had come through. And a lot of them, one guy I talked to was a retired fireman. He tried to get the firemen who were there to come up. They wouldn't do it. He stood in front of his house and watched it burn.
Oh, God. Horrifying. Absolutely horrifying. And, of course, it can happen again. I'm going to be talking tonight on KPFK in Los Angeles about the Santa Susana site, which is an old nuclear site, Rocketdyne, where they had a meltdown, completely covered with radiation, this place, and the fires just swept right over it, and we get no readings from the government about how much radiation might have been in the air. I mean, it's just
absolutely
horrifying.
I've suggested to the people whose houses were saved, but ash and smoke went over, that they have to have a complete chemical wipe of their house. You've got to throw away their mattresses, get their clothes cleaned, because they're all contaminated. And maybe with some of the Santa Susana radioactive stuff. Who knows?
God. Well, ladies and gentlemen listening to the show here, you know, this is the future, unfortunately. And we have a complete moron in the White House, but not for long, hopefully. And maybe we'll get our priorities straight in this country and start using our military for stuff to save people as opposed to destroy it. So I'm going to talk with Ted Vail
for a while here about the Mueller report. We have the two really great experts and activists on the election protection situation. John Brakey, John, are you with us?
I certainly am, Harvey.
Okay, and Steve Rosenfeld?
Yeah, hi.
So, and do we have someone else on the line? Is there another guest on the line?
Yeah, this is Charles Jaco.
Oh, Charles, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Okay, so Charles Jaco is also going to talk about with us. You're in Atlanta, is that right, Charles?
I'm in St. Louis.
Oh, St. Louis, rather. I'm sorry. Yes, St. Louis. You wrote a beautiful piece about Trump and Mueller. So, John and Steve, if you don't mind hanging on, and you're welcome to jump in, I wanted you to devote the second part of the show to Georgia and Florida and the stolen elections there. But I'm sure you guys are both on top of things. And what we're going to discuss to begin with is a Mueller time and what's going to happen. We think, in the near future with the Mueller investigation and the situation with Donald Trump and the law that's been – the laws, the many laws that have been broken, that we presume have been broken. I guess the president – and I put an asterisk next to that president title – is entitled to be considered innocent until proven guilty. However, we have had on this show – and we'll go with Charles and Ted on this first. But as I say, Steve and John, you're welcome to jump in. I have had on this show Craig Unger and Robert K. Johnston. And they have written deep investigative books on the history of Donald Trump and his history with organized crime. Basically, Donald Trump was born a criminal. His father was, a mobbed up developer in New York. And Donald, when he was 6 years old, had a six figure income, and it wasn't from his paper route. So I want to jump into that. Ted and then Charles, you've both written about the Mueller investigation and what you think is going to happen next. So, Ted, do you want to jump in? And then Charles, if you'll follow Ted, that'd be great.
Yeah, I read Charles' excellent article on the sealed indictment, and I know a little bit about that myself. And I am quite confident that over the 18 months of the grand jury proceeding, which should be ending this month or next month, if it started in June or July of 17, Mueller was appointed in May, that they would finish the grand jury, 16 to 23 people, local citizens. They would finish their work on one phase of the of Mueller's work, and like with the Guccifer 2.0, they would issue the indictments. With others, they would just have them sealed. They would Mueller would seal the documents, send them down to the courthouse. They'd be put in a separate file, but as Charles found out, there is a docket which shows that exactly, at least on the face of what was filed. So there are lots of sealed indictments, I believe, that are coming down. And I listed those that I speculated are the people who would be indicted. Jared, Ivanka, Donald, Eric, Roger Stone, Sam Clovis, Hope Hicks, Reince Priebus, Jerome Corsi, Julia Assange, maybe just Jeff Sessions, maybe even our friend Devin Nunez, and Michael Cohen. He's now, they dropped an indictment today on him, which I talk about. And maybe Robert Trump, a name that people don't really know, Donald Trump's brother who works in the Trump Organization business. So that's going to be coming out. Mueller usually drops his indictments on Friday. Congress is now back in session. They're going to be scheduled to end on the 14th, Friday, December 14th, but they're usually late. They may kick it to the 21st of December. I think that would be a good time for a huge Christmas present for those of us who hate Trump. And of course, Donald Trump, he would not indict him. He would name it as an indicted co-conspirator, and I believe he may have already done that, and Trump knows about it, and then he ends up agreeing to do written questions rather than getting involved with the legal issues relating to the unindicted co-conspirator issue, which Richard Nixon was named in the Watergate investigation, and maybe even Vladimir Putin. Our good friend Vladimir Putin might also be an unindicted co-conspirator, and maybe even Mr. Vice President Pence.
Wow. You mentioned in passing, Ted, you just kind of dropped the name Jeff Sessions. Do you think there's a possibility that Mueller would indict Jeff Sessions?
I think so. He has been working in the campaign. He was sitting at the table on March 31, 2016, when they were talking about foreign policy issues. He's been in a lot of conversations. How does Donald Trump operate? He doesn't do emails. He talks on the telephone. He talks face-to-face. So I'm sure they've got a lot of interviews with people that he's talked to, sometimes late at night, Tom Barrack, others like that. Roger Stone, he apparently talks to him late at night. So Hope Hicks, he probably talks to her late at night. And they've all been interviewed, or they tried to interview them. So Donald, there's a lot of information out there, and having been a former federal prosecutor, you do lists of all these things. You have your little cards, and like you see on television, they'll put it over here, this fact, and they build up the facts that they know about each person. And you never ask a question or you don't know the answer to. That's the prosecutor's main thing. So you don't want to be surprised, and I'm sure that's the way Mueller operates. And
wow.
Do you want to hear about how a grand jury operates? Is that something you want to know about?
No, I think we want to move on because we got a ton of content to deal with
today,
and I appreciate that, Ted. Charles, do you want to tell us briefly, tell our viewers who you are and about the piece that you've written, which LA Progressive is where I saw it, and it's really a great piece in terms of figuring out, anticipating what's going to come next year.
Right. I'm a former correspondent for both NBC News and CNN, probably best known for my coverage of the Gulf War. I was been here in St. Louis for 20-some years, where I guess I'm probably best known for as the guy who asked Todd Akin the legitimate rape question that led to his campaign imploding. I've been a journalist for pushing 40 years now, and now I write a column three times a week for a newspaper here, the St. Louis American, which is picked up by the LA Progressive. In this particular piece, I looked at what might be coming given, number one, Mueller and what we know about him, but number two, the laws under which he's operating, because these are not the same special counsel statutes that Lawrence Walsh and others operated under so long ago. The law expired and then it was redone. This one calls specifically for Mueller to issue a report. And it can be at the pleasure of the Attorney General, a confidential report, which the Attorney General could conceivably, and that would be Whitaker right now, the acting AG, could conceivably sit on. Mueller seems to have preempted that because, as Ted noted, if you take a look at the docket for the federal court in Washington, D.C., we know, for example, that in a year and a half, Mueller has got 32 indictments or guilty pleas. But the federal court docket in D.C. shows that you've got about three dozen sealed criminal indictments that have been added to the docket since the first of the year, and 14 of them since August. Now, if you do the math, and I was an English major, so I can't promise that my math is correct, that's about 16% of the total criminal cases filed in D.C. in the federal court are sealed. Now, that's an unusually high number. Ted had, speculated about who might be named in those indictments. There is thought that these indictments were sealed and were entered as a matter of course, or that Mueller is playing a form of three-dimensional chess just in case the Mueller investigation was shut down somehow. He could act before that and issue these sealed indictments. Now, given the new special counsel law, there are essentially three scenarios that play out here in terms of Mueller's report, and they all will involve plunging this country into a constitutional crisis simply because of the way Donald Trump operates. Scenario number one would involve the acting AG Whitaker using his authority to simply fire Mueller. Now, Whitaker has a past of some very shaky business dealings. He has gone on the record numerous times saying the Mueller investigation is a sham because there's one quote from him, there's nothing to find. And Whitaker was never really confirmed by the United States Senate. So if Mueller is shut down, fired, dismissed by Whitaker, you can expect a firestorm even in an extremely compliant GOP-controlled Senate. And that would be the first scenario, that the entire thing gets shut down and that, you know, things proceed from there. Now, scenario number two involves Mueller sending his final report to the Justice Department and the Justice Department essentially burying it. Now, the statute under which Mueller was appointed directs him to deliver such a confidential report. And so conceivably, Whitaker could get a report that damns Trump 10 ways from Sunday. He could keep it under seal. He could keep its contents sealed, and he could refuse to send it to Congress. Now, with the Democratic-controlled House coming in, that could open up an entire can of worms with subpoenas, constitutional crisis, etc. And scenario number three, as, again, Ted noted, would involve Mueller using a grand jury to name Trump as an unindicted co-conspirator. And it is our understanding that because of Cohen's original guilty plea about the payoffs to the two porn stars, the two adult film actresses, that Trump has already been named an unindicted co-conspirator in two different cases. And this comes to from the idea that he violated federal campaign finance law by approving these payoffs. As noted before, the unindicted co-conspirator option has been used by Richard Nixon. The Justice Department, of course, is on record. The Justice Department is on record saying that a sitting president cannot be indicted as opposed to impeached. Now, any one of these three scenarios, Mueller using the grand jury to name Trump either as an indicted person or an unindicted co-conspirator, or Whitaker trying to bury the report, or Whitaker trying to fire Mueller, is going to lead to a major constitutional crisis in this country because we know specifically how Donald Trump will react. Now, with the events that have cascaded upon us just in the last few days, that is Cohen's guilty plea today, indicating that his cooperation has been pretty deep. He pleaded guilty to lying to Congress about the supposed Trump Tower hotel deal that was cooking in Moscow. Interesting, parenthetically, that he pleaded guilty to lying, but his testimony was used as part of the House Intelligence Committee's final report because Devin Nunes was running the committee. And the conclusions it reached were largely due to Cohen's testimony. Cohen's testimony turned out to be false, as he admitted today. You had Manafort's lawyers.
We're saying we have a congressional record that includes lies told by Trump's attorney.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
The final true. House Intelligence Committee report on the entire thing included lies from Cohen in its final report. Because Manafort stopped, according to Mueller, stopped agreeing to cooperate and stopped cooperating and lied to both the special counsel and the FBI. And because Mueller's, Manafort's attorneys were speaking to Trump's attorneys about this at the same time, this opens a fascinating possibility that Mueller's people knew all along that Manafort was a mole, that he was not serious, that he was not, this was not an honest plea, and that they fed him false information, which he gave to his lawyers, which his lawyers gave to Trump's lawyers, which they gave to Trump, which Trump used to craft his written answers to Mueller. Bang, perjury. Which is, you know, I think definitely possible. But
could I jump in? I know that I have done joint defense agreements with a number of other companies that have been sued by the government. They are always in writing, and they are always very careful to state the areas where they can talk. Apparently, the joint defense agreement, the course he talked about, it was totally oral and formal. This is essentially bribery. This is attorney malfeasance by all these attorneys who were involved in passing information from Mueller and the indictments over to Trump and his people.
Exactly. And I think one of the things we need to look for, and this is playing a long game in this, is whether or not the Mueller report, as damning as everyone expects it to be, whether or not it's going to have any effect. Because there are two things at work here. Number one, Nancy Pelosi and the leaders of the House have avoided talking about impeachment because they don't want to have to deal with it for a very simple reason. They know that they could impeach, but the Senate would have to convict, and a Republican-controlled Senate is not going to convict Donald Trump. However, if the Mueller report alleges that the President of the United States may have committed several felonies, then the House, as a matter of civic duty, would have to, almost have to, take up impeachment proceedings.
Yeah, now, offering a pardon to somebody for refusing to tell the facts by the president is bribery. Bribery is an impeachable offense.
Mm-hmm. As is the campaign finance felonies, as
right.
is perjury, as is obstruction of justice. All of
There's
which
also
I think
the
you
issue
were...
that's just come up that suppose Paul Manafort was invited or told by the Russians to try to insinuate himself into the campaign, as he did in March 2016, and he was actually a Russian operative or someone who is going to be killed if he doesn't help the Russians. Mm-hmm. He comes into the campaign, and essentially he's a Russian insider ultimately running the campaign, talking with Donald Trump. Is he talking with Donald Trump about let's get WikiLeaks to get the Hillary Clinton documents, and that is treason by Donald Trump.
Wow.
John Brady or Steve Rosenfeld, I'm sorry.
Either of you want to jump in on this? John or Steve?
Well, I don't... This is Steve. I don't think I can really add... These two fellows really have it together here. You know, the only thing is, you know, I talk to friends of mine who are former federal public defenders, you know, and they don't put that much into the collusion, because collusion is more of a political term than a legal term, but they say stuff like the FBI is fantastic with, you know, possession of stolen property and things like that, and that's what the emails were, you know. So that kind of, I mean, what do you guys think of that?
I think this is unrolling, frankly, and I've covered a lot of mob prosecutions in my time with NBC in New York and with CNN in Miami. I think this is proceeding almost like a classic mob prosecution. You're rolling up the lieutenants and the minor capos trying to get at the boss of bosses, and that's how this is proceeding. The problem is, as I noted before, this isn't a criminal case in the normal sense of a criminal case, because this would end up in the political arena. Let's assume that the House impeaches the president. The United States Senate, controlled by Republicans, would never convict, ever, ever, ever. You need a two-thirds vote. You need 67 senators to convict, unless there is evidence here that just, you know, of treason itself. The second
I'm predicting that, in fact, the House will impeach, and they will be preparing the trial in the Senate, and Donald Trump will say, I'm going to make a deal. I want to stay out of jail. I want my kids to stay out of jail. I want my business back. I've just discovered that I have serious health problems, and I'm going to have to resign the presidency.
Right.
How's
which
that?
Which means that
he's got
Pence.
What was the thing that got him out of the draft?
I'm going way out on a limb there, but that's my prediction, that Trump, who he claims he's a strong guy, but look at with the Trump University thing. I will never settle. He crumped. Trump crumped and paid. You know, Nixon went, he said, okay, I'm gone. I'm out of here. When Barry Goldwater came to him and said, I think you got 4 votes in the Senate, and I'm not one of them. So if these Republicans, a number of them, are there 22 of them up in 2020, if they are essentially going to vote against overwhelming evidence of his guilt, his treason, his bribery, his high crimes and misdemeanors, they're not going to win in 20. And they,
well,
those Republican senators are cowards, too. And a number of them are elected in states that Hillary Clinton won, or we've shown strong evidence right now that that they're trending very Democrat. So I wouldn't be so sure that you can't get 67 votes if you had to. And,
well, I would be stunned. I've looked at the numbers for the senators who are up in 2020, and you hate to say this about your fellow Americans, but I think only 3 of them would be susceptible to pressure: Susan Collins of Maine, John Kyle, who's holding open McCain's seat in Arizona, which is slowly turning blue, and Cory Gardner in, you know, quite blue Colorado. The rest of them are from states like Arkansas, Kentucky, West Virginia, Kansas, Idaho, where I don't think that the constituents who elected the senators there would go for them impeaching Trump, no matter what the evidence. And Ted, this raises
just
a second.
Kansas just turned out the creep Chris Kobach and elected a female an indigenous woman to the House of Representatives. I don't know. It's an interesting, you know, of course, they couldn't even remove Andrew Johnson, for God's sakes. But I think
remember,
By one vote.
Remember, no president has ever been convicted at an impeachment trial. And, Ted, this raises a second possibility that I wanted to run by you and see what you thought.
Okay, then we'll
the
get
second
to,
path, besides impeachment, is indictment. Now, my research... has indicated there are 4 Justice Department memos that have been written since the Watergate era. 3 of them say a president cannot be indicted. 1 from Ken Starr says he can. But you've got 2 U.S. Supreme Court cases, the U.S. versus Nixon and then Bill Clinton versus Paula Jones, both of which the Supreme Court ruled that a sitting president is subject to normal criminal procedures. They didn't mention indictment.
Right.
They stopped short of that. But they said, of course, the president has to answer subpoenas. So
we got Kavanaugh on the court, however, and that good old boy has come out and said he won't. But he should probably have to recuse himself from anything relating to this. But we'll see.
Yeah.
You also had John Roberts sniping at Trump. I'm gonna go out on a limb here, and I'm gonna say that if push comes to shove on a case like that Roberts might very well go against Trump.
If essentially they caved into Trump, John Roberts' Supreme Court would no longer be a co-equal branch of government. They would be subservient to the president. And most important to him is protecting the integrity of the Supreme Court, as he showed in the decision on Obamacare. He came up with a reason largely affirm it. So
John,
it's going to be a very interesting year ahead. particularly for us lawyers and newspaper people who love to have controversy, but this is one that I think a lot of Americans would rather have behind us.
Yeah, John, Mikey, my question for you is very simple. As an attorney, as someone who's practiced, do you believe that a sitting president can be criminally indicted?
I do. Let's say that he murdered somebody. Are you going to say that he can't be indicted for that? Bribery is right there in the, I mean, if he offers a pardon to somebody and it comes out that the person, to prevent him from speaking, that's not only is it an impeachable offense, it's a criminal offense. And it relates directly to the course of his conduct. So I'm not so sure that these senators, other than the three, wouldn't say, my constituents are pounding my office and saying that we're going to drive you out of office if you don't get rid of this president. Let's have a wonderful little Christian Donald Trump in there. Pence in there for the rest of the term.
I think you're correct. I am not quite so sure. But that's the reason I keep harping on the indictment scenario, because, as noted, the Supreme Court has ruled twice that a president is indeed subject to the normal judicial system.
And these other things are
nowhere,
just judicial,
nowhere,
Justice Department rules and regulations. Just like John Yoo said, waterboarding was okay. And now they say, no, it isn't. John Yoo is essentially jumping on the bandwagon against Trump, I see, in a lot of ways.
Right. So, you know,
John Brakey, do you want to chime in here? We are going to switch over to talk about elections in a minute. There's one more thing I want to throw in, but John Brakey, you're in
I'm just
Arizona.
Listening and wanna... very fascinated by the conversation. Thank you.
Oh, you guys are as entertained as I am. So here's a question I want to ask you, both you guys, and all four of you if you want to jump in. Having read The House of Trump, House of Putin by Craig Unger, and It's Even Worse Than You Think by David K. Johnston, Trump's background is a totally criminal background. This guy was raised in the mob, and in the 80s he switched over from the Sicilian mob to the Russian mob. The question, and I want to quote Steve Bannon here, who I just watched for an hour last night. Steve Bannon predicted that it wouldn't be a collusion that brings Trump down. It'd be money laundering. So the question is, did Mueller get into Trump's money laundering for the Russians, which he clearly did and has been doing all along? Is there any chance that this report from Mueller and maybe some of these indictments put their toe into the mob waters of the Trump fortunes? Ted, you want to start with that, and then,
yeah.
And then Charles?
Remember, we have another group of U.S. attorneys in New York who are pursuing a lot of different things, including money laundering, and they've been doing it for many years. And Andrew Weissman, who's heading that group, is a tenacious litigator, and he's heading the financial crimes group. There's also an organized crime group, as well as political corruption, national security, cyber crimes, and appellate among the Mueller group. But financial crimes, they have been doing this far earlier than when Mueller came on board. They were starting to do this years before. So I think when it's going to come out, it's going to be absolutely astounding that the entire Trump empire is based on mob-associated money. And look at Jared Kushner. He suddenly gets out of his problems with the 666 in New York. Amazingly, he got out of that. And
yep.
You have a lot of different elements there. Trump sells his estate next to Mar-a-Lago, bought it for $45 million. During the recession, he sells it for $95 million. A lot of Russians are buying into his hotels and condos. And since 2008, he's had only Russian money really supporting him, and Deutsche Bank money. Interesting fact there: the Deutsche Bank person that was laundering Russian money through to him was the son of Anthony Kennedy, the Supreme Court justice, who just
resigned. Who conveniently stepped down to let, what's his name in? Charles, you want to comment on that?
Well, I think one of the fascinating things that happened today was that this morning, European time, German authorities raided Deutsche Bank.
They did.
In a money laundering investigation involving Russian oligarchs. Now, remember, Deutsche Bank was practically the only legitimate, quote, close quote, financial institution on the planet that would still do business with Donald Trump because of his multiple business bankruptcies. Deutsche Bank has also been implicated very seriously in aiding and abetting Russian oligarchs who have embezzled and siphoned off tens of billions of dollars from Russia and have laundered it through banks from Panama to Cyprus to the Caymans. Now, there has been speculation, and I have no knowledge as to whether this is true or not, but there has been some speculation that the raid on Deutsche Bank this morning could very well have been, if not instigated by, then aided and abetted by Mueller's people. Because have plenty of information, as Ted noted, about potential money laundering, and the German federal authorities said, well, we've had these guys in our crosshairs for a while, and P.S., we hate Trump anyway, so let's shake the tree really hard and see how many loose apples fall to the ground.
What you often have is
it's unbelievable.
They have a lot of information. They go forward. This is the prosecutors. But then they get another witness who comes forward or somebody pleads guilty, and there's more information. And they've got to go back and dig a little more. So, I mean, this is an incredibly complex set of facts here with emoluments, corruption, conspiracy, collusion, obstruction of justice, all of these different things that meld together and also are separate as far as whether a crime is committed. And you're dealing with, is a crime committed and is an impeachable offense committed? Two separate categories.
Well, I think you're making a mistake here using the singular. Listen, I want to invite you two guys back, and of course John and Steve can come back also next week, because the one thing we're sure of is that there's going to be more coming out between now and next week. So Ted and Charles, if you can join me next week again for the update. I got
to
tell you, in 1973, I was on a beach in Mexico with a beautiful woman. I read the first of the stories on Watergate, and I just had to come home. I got to tell you, this is going to be a really spectacular couple of years coming up. I think the only question is, when does Trump leave? And I think you got it 100% right, Ted. I think his bone spurs are going to kick up, and you know, he's going to cut all the deals that he can cut with Mike Pence and whoever else, and he's going to get out. And the other thing is that we're going to find his tax returns, and we're going to discover his net worth is 25 cents. But listen, Charles, and
Mueller's had his tax returns for a long time, I'm sure. He can get them easily.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I'm sure Mueller's had them, and I'm sure Mueller will find a way to get all this stuff out, because he's a million times smarter than the guy that they put in. So if you guys will come back and join me next week, I'd be honored. Well, and if you want to stay on, you're going to hear now the two leading experts, and I mean this, on what happened in Florida and Georgia. And we don't want to let too much time pass before we hear about that. And Steve Rosenfeld and John Brakey have been right at the belly of the beast there. So, Steve, and thank you guys both for this. And please do stay on.
Okay. We'll see what happens, as Donald Trump said.
Yes, okay. Well, Steve Rosenfeld and John Brakey, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Certainly am.
Okay, well, it doesn't get any better than this. Steve, you have been in Florida and in Georgia, as has John. We still have a major outstanding lawsuit from Stacey Abrams on voter suppression in Georgia. You want to start with an overview? We've got a full 20 minutes, and we can deal with this.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is fairly remarkable to me. I haven't seen a lawsuit like this in many years, and what I mean by that is, basically, she categorized all these different actions by the Secretary of State through administrative orders and directives, or Georgia state law, that basically prevented people from voting or registering or participating or enrolling in some part of the process. And I think the key phrase I've heard in other federal court rulings is through no fault of their own. And that's really important, because if you take a look at all the federal court rulings, and there were four in Georgia and one in Florida before I stopped following them all, or I lost track, those federal judges are not looking to rewrite state election codes. They're looking for gaps in the process where the government somehow injures the citizens by preventing them from participation. And when it concerns voting, you get these constitutional violations, and because you're depriving people of being able to participate equally. And then when you have different standards or no standards, you get this equal protection or lack of equal treatment. So what she did was she filed this lawsuit that invoked all of these constitutional thresholds, which would allow a federal court to come in and tell Georgia that you have to stop following a series of state laws and you need to start implementing a series of remedies that basically would allow people to participate. And what's most notable about all that is when you get towards the end of this suit, and they have, you know, they call it the prayer for relief, that she lists, I counted them, 13 or 14 different actions that a new Secretary of State could literally issue or demand upon taking office that would just simply change the direction, remove barriers, and make things like the way most Americans expect voting to be, which is, if you're eligible, you can participate. And if you participate, your vote will be counted and counted accurately. So anyway, we'll see what happens here, but mostly, there, you know, next Tuesday there is a runoff election in Georgia for Secretary of State. Now, I don't think the candidate who's as a Democrat is particularly charismatic. He's not particularly liberal, but he is committed to a fair-minded process. And sometimes the remedies in situations like this are more effective if they're political than if they're judicial. So let's see if this guy wins. And in the meantime, the lawsuit is a modern catalog of everything that could be done to tilt the process, from voter registration to voter purges to not having your ballots validated, being rejected, not notified. It just goes on and on and on and on. So I'll leave it there.
Well, what do you think of the quality of it?
The quality of the argument?
The lawsuit,
I think that a fair-minded federal judge will have no choice but to find some rulings in her favor. But I don't know that ordering this Justice Department to oversee elections in Georgia is such a hot idea.
Okay. John Brakey, you want to jump in?
Well, I would say that, Chris Sauter, who I work very closely with, one of the best election attorneys in the country, he was in Georgia after being in Kansas election day. He was shipped to Georgia, and he told me that he never, in his whole career of doing elections, since 1968, working in the Kennedy, Robert Kennedy campaign, he's never seen voter suppression as bad as the tricks that were done in Georgia. Just very sad. And of course, we know the history from the activism that many have done over the years, how they wiped out the hard drives on the primary the last February. So, you know, we start the year with Georgia, we end the year with Georgia, among other states, of course, Florida. You know, that's what I'm heavily involved in. And also, I was so pleased to see Stephen show up in Florida, too, and that we could get together. Stephen is writing some incredible articles, and we need to share his stuff because he's very articulate in being able to really tell the stories of what's happening out here in on the election front. Because, you know, I'm more of an investigator, and I'm very intuitive, and I wish I had the writing skills that Steve has.
Well, what happened? I'm gonna go out on a limb here and say that it seems to me that if there had not been voter suppression and other tricks played in these two states, that Stacey Abrams, in fact, would have been elected governor.
Harvey, it's uncontestable, and the numbers alone. So check it out. The Republican Party of Georgia says that we had record turnout, and therefore, what's the problem? You know, we had more people participating than ever. Well, that may be true, but on the other hand, if you take a look at the number of people who were otherwise disqualified and the localities where they were, and how those localities voted, it's almost undeniable that there was this tremendous, blue wave that would have that should have elected her if things were fairer. I mean, the Secretary of State of Georgia purged 750,000 people. On one night, he purged 500,000 people. This is all in the lawsuit, and it was done under a Georgia state law that was written a year after the Motor Voter, which is it's called the Federal Motor Voter. It's the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. And basically, it was written in such a way where if you only vote in presidential years, you can get purged. And the only time this fellow, Kemp, has invoked this is in years that he's run for re-election or for new office. and that's just one thing. I mean, we're talking about so many things. They ran out of provisional ballots. Provisional ballots are the backup ballot which has to be validated. Well, a lot of people, thousands of people, did not get provisional ballots. They were told to come back or they were turned away. The provisional ballots that were turned in were then disqualified based on very random signature matchings. There are no signature matching standards. Some of the absentee ballots that go in there, they call it the exact match standard. If you don't fill in your name and your date of birth properly, you don't get counted there. It just goes on and on and on. There were other things there where Georgia is so schizophrenic. They have automatic voter registration for people who get a driver's license. But like several other states this fall, they're not forwarding the most recent changes of address to their election offices. So then all of a sudden you're using bad data to invalidate people's votes. I mean, all of this stuff is happening.
You're pretty sure that in a fair election, Stacey Abrams would have won. And she's pretty sure, too, apparently. So this lawsuit that you're referring to, Steve Rosenfeld, sounds like a really a monumental document in terms of voter protection. I mean, clearly her staff of lawyers wanted to make a statement about protecting the vote. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, look, Harvey, this lawsuit could drag on for years, and it's not, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with the lawsuit. For example, yesterday, the Greens settled a lawsuit with the state of Pennsylvania over their completely, they refused to recount, to do recounts in many, many counties in November 2016. They settled it yesterday. With the promise that they will buy you know, they'll buy new voting systems using paper ballots for 2020, and for 2022, they'll have some kind of audit process where they'll be able to verify the votes. That took 2 years.
Was that Jill Stein?
That was Jill Stein.
Was it unbelievable? So they just settled?
This was yesterday. It was a settlement yesterday. I talked to Jill Stein earlier today. And the thing about this is we don't know what's going to happen with Stacey Abrams and her lawsuit. We don't know who's going to get elected Secretary of State next week. It's just that, you know, it's just a frustrating game that we keep seeing being played here, where there's just a well-known catalog of rules. Every time, every cycle, you have a couple new twists in them. The biggest cycle, this cycle was, we're not going to forward your change of addresses from one state agency motor vehicles to another elections, and therefore it's going to disqualify some untold number of votes.
God, mind-boggling. Well, what did they do in Florida? They played the same kind. I mean, obviously, Andrew Gillum ran a little behind Bill Nelson, but nonetheless, those elections also were in play.
I don't think you can talk about Florida in the same way as Georgia. I heard different explanations in Florida for why Gillum lost, and they sound believable to me. And, you know, John can chime in here, too. What I basically heard was that they had a late August primary, and that Gillum wasn't expected to win, and statewide, the Democrats did not have much of what they call a ground game, which where you could compare that to Georgia, where Stacey Abrams had tremendous grassroots support. And they kind of believed the polls for the first time since the 90s, a Democrat was leading for governor. I think it was Lawton Childs. So they got a little complacent.
Yeah, Lawton Childs.
And that's what I heard. And I heard that from this fellow that John was talking about, Chris Sauter, who was hired by the Democratic Party of Broward County to go in there and watch what was going on. And he basically said they didn't have a ground game. And I heard that when I ran into people in Tallahassee. When all these people showed up to be observers for the recounts, people were literally saying, where were you last week in terms of getting out the vote?
John, John, you spent a lot of time in Florida. What do you think happened there?
Well, I think Steve's summing it up pretty good, and I can add some of the horrible things that I found. I mean, you know, starting off with that, you know, we filed records requests across the whole state because of the August 28th primary, and then found out that 64% of all the public records of the ballot images were destroyed within those 22-month period. And then we go to the Secretary of State and say, hey, you know, you're doing this wrong, and here's the law. Here's some time to correct, and they play games, continue us out. And so we wind up suing the whole state of Florida. We're in litigation now on that, and now it's more of, you know, protecting future elections. I know a lot of the images from this last election were destroyed in Broward County. You know, I happened to pick the right county to be at the eye of the storm because it did turn in that way. And you know, there's so many possible things that could have happened. But in the senatorial race, you know, I blame Broward County because those 30,000 undervotes, 70% would have gone to Nelson, and that 70% pretty much may have put him over, and he would have won the election. And that's because of poor ballot design, and they designed it exactly the way you shouldn't have done it. There was 30,000 undervotes in the in that senatorial race on the top of the ticket, very top. But if you go to the governor's race on the same page, they designed that one right. There was only 5,000 undervotes. And this doesn't add to the fact that we were there on election night. I'm out there with six crews, you know, trying to film the fact that 48 all the ES&S counties in the state of Florida, 48 of them, are connected by cell phone to the central computer. And, you know, that's like being connected to the Internet. And they say, gee, it's a protected network. Nobody could get in. But the reality is that insiders who we have to fear, and that's what I'm worried about, not Russians coming in. I'm worried about a programmer who's being blackmailed or who's in the deal and rigging it because, you know, when they do recounts in Florida, all they do is look at the undervotes, and they say that they know that everything else is being added up right because they ran a logic and accuracy test. And by the way, that's the same thing as an emission test run by Volkswagen in my book.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's no good. And but, you know, I'm a conspiracy factualist, so I'm going to keep hammering out there with Steve and others to collect the facts. And so really, what do I think happened down there? I'm waiting to get the facts, and I'll be able to report when I get that. And those ballot images, we're hitting the whole state.
Oh, my God.
We're going to get them.
Listen, we've got to do this again next week. Thank you, Charles. Ted, come back next week. Steven and John will pursue this. Thank you, crew in New York. Unbelievable. What a country. Talk to you next week in Silvertopia.
Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many